I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Meresham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau, Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Sade 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallaxes listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be talking with John Hoffman, author of the foreign policy piece, Israel is a Strategic Liability for the United States. This article that John wrote questions the strategic value of what is known as the U.S.-Israel special relationship, and argues that it may be time to reassess that relationship, not necessarily meaning that the U.S. and Israel should become enemies, but rather that relations need to be normalized between the two countries and that we need to move beyond the special relationship, not just for the sake of the United States, but also Israel. More on why John believes that in the conversation to follow. This piece, though, I gotta say, it has gotten some attention. It's garnered some attention in various places, most notably on MSNBC. John was interviewed on a segment of MSNBC recently, so this is really gaining some traction, this article, and I'm glad John could make some time to speak about it with me. So, with that being said, let's get right to it with John Hoffman. Welcome to Parallax Views. A guest that I'm really, really happy we could get on. He was recently on MSNBC. He was interviewed on Background Briefing with Ian Masters because he wrote an article in Foreign Policy that we're going to talk about. But he is John Hoffman, a policy analyst in defense and foreign policy at the Cato Institute and a professor at George Mason University, specializing in Middle East geopolitics and political Islam. And I believe he was recently awarded the 40 Under 40 Award from the Middle East Policy Council for his work on U.S. foreign policy in the region. His work's been featured in many places. But today we're going to be talking about his foreign policy article, Israel is a Strategic Liability for the United States. The special relationship does not benefit Washington, and it is endangering U.S. interests across the globe. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well, JG. How are you?
I'm doing good. I really was, you know, pleased to see your article in Foreign Policy because, you know, it seems like this idea that you're talking about in the article, that Israel is becoming a strategic liability for the U.S., has been talked about in the past by a number of different thinkers, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, for instance. But now I think it's becoming more
I don't want to say mainstream, but more people are talking about it. And there's at least some people taking it more seriously than maybe they did 10 years ago. But for people that haven't been in the loop, why is Israel a strategic liability for the US?
Sure. Yeah, and it is interesting that you mentioned Stephen and John because this is very in line with their work. I spoke with John after I published this piece, and it seems like this message is becoming, far more mainstream, which, from my perspective, is a good thing. But ultimately, what I'm arguing is the United States has a unique relationship with Israel. So John F. Kennedy was the one who called it a quote unquote special relationship. And at the heart of this special relationship is just the American indifference to Israel's actions, the $300 billion adjusted for inflation that Israel has received from the United States since World War II, and the $3.8 billion that they continue to get annually. And, I tried to, with this article, highlight that there is a fundamental disconnect between Israeli interests and American interests, as well as the values that we as a country, as the United States, claim to stand for. And it tries to show that over the past 5 months, almost 6 months now, actually, over the past almost 6 months, this disconnect between the United States and Israel has really come to the forefront during the war in Gaza. And the past 6 months have just really comprehensively and succinctly shown this fundamental disconnect.
I know there's probably some people that have responded to your article saying, oh, this is just an anti-Israel hit piece. But I think your article actually has a lot to offer for even very pro-Israel voices because, this special relationship maybe has had a negative impact on Israel's domestic political scene, especially in light of the reign of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for who has been around for, I think like over 2 decades now, on and off, but like pretty much he's been in power in Israel for quite some time.
No, and that's a great point. And I've spoken, after this article to many, staunch defenders of Israel, and they've said the same thing. Israelis themselves, have started, many have started to question this special relationship because what I argue in the piece is that the United States, by subsidizing, what Netanyahu is doing, by su subsidizing Israeli policies for, X number of decades, we've insulated Israel from the ramifications of these policies. And they're not sustainable in the long term. They're not sustainable for Israelis, I would argue, because, the only path towards peace between Israelis and Palestinians is one in which both peoples have a mutual security, have a mutual dignity. So the United States, by presenting itself as the quote unquote peacemaker and having all the answers, but by so heavily subsidizing one side, we've obscured any sort of genuine path to peace here. And I think it's time for the United States to say, what we're doing isn't really helping. It's not good for us. It's not good for Israel. It's clearly not good for the Palestinians. And
Has
it's
it
really
arguably helped right-wing elements in Israel, like Netanyahu? I know he's often considered center-right, but I mean, even over these years, we've seen the rise of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. Do you think that the special relationship maybe affects Israel domestic policy in that way?
No, I would definitely say it does. This kind of blank check subsidy that the United States provides has fueled some of the worst actors in Israeli politics. Whether that be, the settler mo movement, or whether that be, like you mentioned, the Ben-Gvirs or the Smotriches of the world, who are very extreme. And it's fueled, Netanyahu in particular, his personal grasp on power. Netanyahu is, first and foremost considered or concerned with his own power. And this blank check from the United States has, like you correctly pointed out, it has really fueled some of the worst actors in Israeli politics.
I wanted you to be able to address this issue that always comes up. Proponents of this special relationship often claim that this relationship advances U.S. interests in the Middle East. And you mentioned Senator Lindsey Graham referring to Israel as the eyes and ears of America in the region, sort of our spy in the region, so to speak, in a way. How would you respond to those proponents?
Sure. So, the biggest, I guess, point of criticism I got with the article was people pushing back saying, well, Israel provides us with critical intelligence in the Middle East. And I said, okay, I'm sure they do. I'm sure there is, intelligence cooperation. I'm sure, much of it is valuable. But are we really going to act like it's not in Israel's strategic interest to cooperate with us in terms of intelligence and share this intelligence? Does it require $3.8 billion in annual aid to Israel, continued, diplomatic cover, these vetoes at the UN, so on and so forth, and the $14 billion, package just passed by the Senate, in additional military aid? So when people say Israel is our eyes and ears in the Middle East, I try to bring this question back to, well, what are our interests in the Middle East, and is Israel, how does Israel represent our eyes and ears? Because from my point of view, U.S. interests in the Middle East are very limited. They should be centered on advancing the prosperity and the safety of the American people and the values that we as a nation claim to adhere to. How does continued indifference and turning a blind eye to Israeli affronts to those interests, so this whole thing is one big paradox. And what I try to do with this article is bring this back to ask, what the hell are we doing?
What do you think the biggest issues are with the U.S.-Israel special relationship? How does this hurt the U.S. long term? If you were to, give us some bullet points for that.
Sure. So I think first and foremost, it undermines our interests in the Middle East. U.S. Middle East policy has really been centered on two foundational pillars for over 8 decades. One is unwavering support for the state of Israel, and the other is what I refer to as the myth of authoritarian stability. This idea that autocrats in the Middle East, like Mohammed bin Salman, Mohammed bin Zayed, are the best upholders of American interests. These two pillars represent the foundations of an unstable and illiberal order in the Middle East that is unsustainable in the long term. So when I say that they undermine our interests in the Middle East, it's upholding this artificial construct, this artificial order in the Middle East that's only upheld via, fierce exclusion, repression, and security guarantees from the US. But it's also undermining our interests on a global scale. Particularly, these past 6 months have shown that pretty dramatically. The world sees the United States vetoing these UN resolutions. The world sees this hypocrisy between supporting what's going on in Gaza and then talking about upholding a rules-based order in Ukraine. People see this. And the tarnishing of America's image that has happened in the past 6 months, I think, will take generations to fix. And it's still ongoing. It's still being tarnished.
What do you make so far of how the Biden administration has handled the Gaza war? And a lot of people will defend the Biden administration right now, saying, well, they're putting these sanctions, for instance, on the settlers. But I think upon closer inspection, there's even issues with that. It seems very liberalist in a way. Could you speak to the issues with how Biden has carried out policy since the Gaza war broke out?
Sure. So, Biden's Middle East policy has remained consistent, and his policy on October 6th is the exact same as his policy was on October 7th, as it was on October 8th, and as it is now. So, Biden is doubling down on these, underlying rationales of U.S. Middle East policy that sees the United States, constantly resorting to this playbook of throwing money, weapons, and military assets at the region, saying, oh man, well, this must stabilize things, right? But no, the Biden administration has, simply continued what are decades of failed US Middle East policy? And what is truly mind-boggling is the way that he's doubled down on them and just refuses to change course. And like you just mentioned, the symbolic acts, is what I refer to them in the piece, the sanctioning of specific settlers or the, claiming that they're inconsistent with international law. This won't move the needle at all. This is empty rhetoric. Absent real policy change on behalf of the United States, this isn't going to do anything. And going back to, my previous point about hypocrisy, look at the recent UN resolution that passed. The United States was the one that removed permanent ceasefire from the resolution in order for it to pass. They immediately came out like a couple hours afterwards and said it's not binding. But of course, if this were Ukraine or anything else, they would perceive it as binding. And just last week, the Biden administration approved billions of dollars in bombs and fighter jets to Israel. So, the world sees this hypocrisy. The American people see this hypocrisy. And, Biden, Biden is being Biden. He hasn't been on the right side of a foreign policy issue in, it's almost his entire career. So.
Also, I think a big issue with this special relationship is, I mean, you currently have Israel really showing that it has, as you point out, no long-term political strategy in Gaza beyond, just destruction. I don't know what their goal is. I mean, they say elimination of Hamas, but what does that mean, and how are you going to get there? And I think there's been intelligence reports saying that's very unlikely, the total elimination of Hamas. And there's also, just it seems like there's no strategic goals. And yet the US, what are we doing about that? What, how are we responding to that? It seems like we're giving them a blank check.
No, precisely. And I'm really glad that you brought this point up because Netanyahu, from day one, Netanyahu said the goal is to eradicate Hamas. Okay, great. How are you going to do that? Because both militarily and politically, that is virtually impossible. You can degrade Hamas militarily. You can, undermine its ability to launch attacks, so on and so forth. But Hamas is interwoven into the political context of Gaza and of the Palestinian question more generally. Khaled Al-Gindi over at the Middle East Institute did a phenomenal article for Foreign Affairs looking at this particular predicament, saying, this is an impossible objective. And as I argue in the piece here, Israel has demonstrated no long-term strategy for Gaza other than just death and destruction. So, we haven't even begun to think about, how is life supposed to return to northern Gaza? How, this is, the entire strip has been decimated. This, there, you have people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich who talk about quote unquote voluntary migration of people from Gaza to the Sinai or other countries. But it should be pretty obvious that if bombs are dropping on your house and if the only option is leave or die, it's not voluntary. They've demonstrated no strategy aside from just the destruction of the enclave and its inhabitants. But the United States, on the other hand, just keeps writing the blank checks, like you said.
Do you think also the lack of the US leveraging itself when it comes to its relationship with Israel? I think it's led to this situation where, I mean, we just had Netanyahu reveal his post-war plan. It's different than Biden's post-war plan, which, to be fair, Biden's post-war plan, while it's nice that it's talking about creating a Palestinian state or getting a pathway to it, there's no concrete plans in that, blueprint that they talk about in the Biden administration. However, I mean, at the end of the day, we have in Benjamin Netanyahu someone who I think is pretty openly thumbing their nose at the Biden administration, saying there isn't going to be a Palestinian state. Can you comment on that and the ways in which this relationship is, I guess, really lopsided and also, I would say, embarrassing in a way for the US?
No, absolutely. So Netanyahu openly speaks about his ability to manipulate the United States. He boasts about it. And you know, I think what we've seen is, you know, going back to that symbolic action that we talked about, the sanctioning of the Israeli settlers and saying that these settlements are now, you know, reversing Trump's decision to say that they aren't in violation of international law. Biden, you know, administration now says they are. Immediately following that, Netanyahu announces the plan for 3,400 new Israeli settlements in the West Bank. So that's a direct, you know, thumbing your nose or, you know, towards Biden. And, you know, all of these things, you know, whether it be instances like that or whether it be talk about a two-state solution, Biden or Netanyahu since October 7th has proudly, you know, said, you know, that he is, you know, the one who has blocked a two-state solution, that he is the only one that can prevent a two-state solution going forward. And Israeli officials such as Netanyahu and others have pressured the United States behind the scenes to stop talking about a two-state solution. So, you know, you have on the one hand Biden having this blueprint that mentions a two-state solution, and then you have on the other hand Israel who's saying that will never happen. So which one is it here? Because you know, this is truly, you know, from my, you know, point of view, you know, and I feel like you probably feel the same. You know, this is, you know, not only a strategic disaster, but it's embarrassing too.
What do you say when people respond to that by saying, well, you know, things will change once Netanyahu is out of office, and then we'll have someone in office in Israel that is more willing to listen to US recommendations? How would you respond to people who say that really the problem is just Netanyahu? It's not the nature of the relationship that we have with Israel.
So I would say, you know, the issues extend far deeper than just Netanyahu as an individual. You know, whether, you know, Netanyahu currently, you know, his polling numbers are abysmal. All polls show that if early elections were to be held in Israel, he'd be obliterated. A tremendous amount of Israelis are taking to the streets calling for his ouster. But let's say he's replaced with Benny Gantz, who is, you know, most polls show that if elections were to be held, Benny Gantz would likely become premier. Would we see a considerable shift in Israeli policy? I don't think so, because there's been a lot of great academic work over the past several years that has shown when attacks happen and when Israel engages in wars and when attacks on Israel happen, you typically have an even harder shift to the right among the Israeli populace. So, you know, it's Netanyahu who so many people in Israel right now are angry with, but it's not necessarily the war in Gaza that they're angry with. They're angry that the hostages haven't been brought back. They're angry that Netanyahu's putting his political survival ahead of other, you know, national issues. But whether we'll see a shift, a tangible shift in Israeli policy or the U.S.-Israel relationship, I wouldn't hold my breath on that.
What do you see as the most, I guess, concrete ways that the US-Israel special relationship has either affected foreign policy or just US interests in the past? And, you know, what are some potential ways it could be harmful in the future?
Yeah, so you know, I think this special relationship, and it's really an uneven relationship. It's largely unidirectional. You know, when you're engaging with any partners, when the United States engages with treaty allies like Japan or South Korea, for example, there's a push and pull. You know, there's a give and take. But you know, as I said the other day, you know, there's with Israel, it's just all give. There's no take here, and what is really, you know, detrimental here is our emphatic embrace of Israel and our inability to differentiate between Israeli interests and American interests have skewed our ability to even think clearly about the Middle East, to think clearly about, you know, what our role in the region should be, what are actual American interests in the region. And this, you know, I cite in the article one example, you know, Israel trying to push the United States towards direct confrontation with Iran. And I think, you know, there is the risk that this conflict will still explode into a regional wide war, you know, especially with Israel's, you know, recent strikes in Syria, the strike on the Iranian consulate. You know, this has the risk of spiraling out of control, and this would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. So in the short term, I think, you know, region-wide war is probably the most concerning, you know, development that would be, you know, catastrophic to our interests. But, you know, in the long term, you know, I would say it's America's image. It's our broader engagement with countries in the Middle East, with the Arab and Muslim world, you know, so on and so forth.
Two things in that regard. Do you think this can also affect our relations with countries outside of the Middle East that may be, you know, sympathetic to the Palestinians? So I'm thinking of Brazil under Lula da Silva. I think, you know, Brazil is a developing nation. It's growing in a lot of ways. Could that be a bad thing? You know, the fact that countries that may be more sympathetic and developing, that are sympathetic to Palestinians, could this harm our relationships with them?
So I think, you know, whether, you know, in addition to, you know, countries that are more sympathetic to the Palestinians, I think there's just this more, also this more general, you know, perception of the United States among the global South in particular that,
The
you
US
know,
is hypocritical when it comes to the rules-based
exactly.
order. Yeah.
Yeah. So like any talk of a rules-based order, you know, was already, you know, kind of people looked at it like, yeah, right. But now, since October 7th and, you know, the unwavering support for what Israel's been doing, it's just so much more blatant. I have a colleague at the Cato Institute, Mustafa Akyol, who wrote a really good piece for Foreign Policy called "The West is Losing Muslim Liberals." And, you know, I agree with him. You know, what we're doing is actively undermining the values that we claim to stand for. You know, this liberal world order, quote unquote, has turned out to be nothing more than, you know, the United States trying to preserve its hegemony abroad. And it's just so blatant in the past 6 months.
And then, in regards to Iran, do you think the U.S.-Israel special relationship has? I'll just bring up the JCPOA. We never really got back into it. Do you think the special relationship may have played a role in why it's been so hard, doing that kind of relationship with Iran, the nuclear deal, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. Because any, you know, engagement with Iran is often portrayed as being anti-Israel, you know, and going against Israel's interests, so on and so forth. Look, Iran is a horrible actor in the Middle East. I don't think anybody would debate that. But so is Saudi Arabia, so is the UAE, so is Egypt. You know, so what I'm trying to get at here is by boxing ourselves in and by trying to uphold this artificial regional balance of power, this artificial authoritarian status quo within the Middle East, the United States is undermining its own interests because upholding these things costs so much money, so much human costs involved too. And none of this is in the interests of the United States. So the U.S. special relationship with Israel, you know, the key point that I'm trying to make in here is it obscures our ability to think clearly about the Middle East as a region.
Just a few more things I wanted to cover, and I know you don't cover this in the article, but do we have examples of past administrations that maybe in some way or another challenged the U.S.-Israel special relationship? One topic that has come up on this show a lot is George H.W. Bush and his showdown with AIPAC. Are there examples like that that you think are useful to look at?
Well, there's that example. There's the example of Ronald Reagan, you know, trying to get tough with Israel over, you know, bringing back its troops from Lebanon. But we've never seen really a fundamental rethinking of this special relationship. You know, we've seen, you know, the United States try to pressure Israel on, you know, certain policy issues, and like George H.W. Bush with the in terms of the aid and you know, assurances that it won't go towards fueling settlements and things like that. But we've never seen a really taking any leader taking a step back and saying, wait, hold on, what is this special relationship for again? What do we get out of this? So whether we will see that, we definitely won't see it under Biden, but whether we will see that in the near future is still doubtful, because 2024, you have Donald Trump and Biden, who are, going to be running for the presidency here. And both of them, still adhere to this overwhelming mindset of American primacy in the Middle East, of which Israel is a central pillar, or perceived to be as a central pillar.
What's the role of lobbying in regards to the US-Israel special relationship? And is that changing at all? Because I know a lot of people talk about AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, but there's also sort of a challenger Israel lobby called J Street, which there's still a pro-Israel lobby, but they're, I think, a little bit more liberal about things. And, they're even open to criticism of Israel, whereas I think AIPAC is very much wedded to a sort of Likud party ideology. What do you make of AIPAC, and do you think its role in DC is changing at all?
Yeah, so I mentioned in the article, Israel commands attention on both sides of the political aisle, and that's because of these various forms of direct and indirect lobbying and influence. AIPAC is, the epitome of it. Everybody knows about AIPAC. Whether or not this conflict has undermined AIPAC's ability to, or any other, pro-Israel, supporters or groups, so on and so forth, whether it's undermined their ability to shape outcomes in Washington, I think that still remains to be seen. But what I try to get across in the piece is, it's through direct campaign contributions. It's through the funding of think tanks. It's through the funding of academic projects that, Israel and its supporters, and supporters of just an overall expansive U.S. presence in the Middle East, they have a very large voice in Washington, D.C. And when, you speak out against these things, and when you challenge these underlying assumptions, you are very much the odd man out. Will this be a turning point, like a paradigm shifting moment? I don't want to be on record, trying to claim either way. I think, in terms of opening up the debate, I think it's been opened in a manner that past conflicts have not allowed for. And this, I think things are changing in terms of the conversations that we're having. Absolutely.
In terms of, normalization of US-Israel relations, you're not the only person I've heard say this. I've also heard, of all people, Matthew Iglesias, who is very much a centrist sort of liberal type pundit, say this. And I've seen other people say it. But for people that are maybe in the dark about these things, what does normalization entail? Like, what kind of policies would we see in terms of a normalization of US-Israel relations?
Sure. So when I say it's time to, like, quote unquote, normalize the U.S.-Israel relationship, I'm not saying it's time to make Israel an enemy of the United States or anything like that. I'm saying that it's time to approach Israel the way the United States should approach any country. And that is from arm's length and based solely on the perspective of what are we getting out of this relationship? So in other words, U.S. interest. When people hear that, I often, and they challenge it, I often remind them, even with treaty allies, France, South Korea, so on and so forth, like I said, there's a push and pull. There's a recognition that their interests aren't always our own, and our interests aren't always theirs. So when I say it's time to normalize this relationship, I'm saying, no longer would these decisions about military aid, arms sales, diplomatic cover be rooted in just, muscle memory like they have for the past 8 decades, but it would be centered on, the perceptions of what U.S. interests are at stake.
In terms of normalization, could this also be applied to other US relations in the region?
Oh, absolutely. So, it's the same thing with Saudi Arabia. It's the same thing with Egypt. It's the same thing with the UAE. There's, Since really, 9/11, the Middle East has been exceptionalized in U.S. foreign policy. Our relationships with a lot of these actors and a lot of these states on paper don't make a whole lot of sense. Whether it be, Saudi Arabia, for example, is, a country that I've focused on a lot. So there's this real need for the United States to take a step back and acknowledge the failures of its own Middle East policies, and how its own policies, how its own deep presence in the region, and how its partners have and have support for all of these things have really resulted in a vicious cycle whereby we're encountering problems that are a product of our presence, policies, and partners in the Middle East.
What would a fundamental rethinking of U.S. Middle East policy look like? I mean, I think there's been talk in the past of pivoting out of the Middle East, especially after the disastrous Iraq War and things of that nature. But it seems like, I mean, what do you think drives this obsession with being so involved in the Middle East rather than, maybe being, less involved in it?
Yeah, so I think there's numerous reasons here. One is challenging the special relationship with Israel or challenging America's relationship with Saudi Arabia and stuff like that, has for a long time been taboo. Whether it be people's professional career ambitions, whether it be looking for funding and so on and so forth, people typically don't like this. Challenge these issues because they're kind of assumed to be non-starters. But I think there's also, a overwhelming mindset in DC of American primacy that the United States needs to be everywhere doing everything all at once that makes it almost impossible for the United States to even perceive of playing a lesser role in the Middle East. So I think, in order for a fundamental rethinking of U.S. Middle East policy, we have to first understand what American interests are, and then we have to understand how we situate the Middle East within that broader picture of American interests. And like you mentioned, the pivot to Asia, when you start looking at other critical theaters around the world, heightening tensions with China over Taiwan, or increasingly, involved with Ukraine, or in Ukraine. We have $33 trillion in national debt running $2 trillion a year deficits. When you start taking into account all of these things, the Middle East ranks pretty far down on this list, or should, but it does play an outsized role in Washington because of, this exceptionalized notion of the Middle East, because of a lot of lobbying, because of a lot of special interests.
Before we close out here, what do you think the worst outcomes are in regards to the U.S.-Israel special relationship and the continuation of the Gaza war? Like, what do you think could happen if there isn't a pivot out of this? Because you obviously wrote the article out of concern that this is going to lead in bad places. You actually write. The Biden administration faces a choice: continue following the Netanyahu government into the abyss, or forcefully pressure it to change course. Now, into the abyss is some strong words, so maybe you can explain where you think this could all lead.
Sure. So I think, unfortunately, I think, as things are progressing right now, I think the worst days are still ahead of us, particularly if Israel pushes into Rafah, a full ground invasion of Rafah. I think that will be the bloodiest phase of all of this because 1.5 million Palestinians are now packed into Rafah. So when I say they can follow Netanyahu into the abyss, I mean, one, within Gaza, things could, although it's hard to believe, get much worse. Two is the regional ramifications of this. You saw Israel's strikes in Syria. You saw the strikes on the Iranian consulate. You see tensions continuing to flare between Hezbollah and Israel. You've seen 170 attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria since October 7th. And you see the continued tit for tat escalation between the United States and the Houthis in Yemen. So this really risks spiraling out of control. I remember, speaking to a member of Congress about this issue, and I said it is only a matter of time before we wake up to news of a mass casualty event involving U.S. troops. If things continue down this road, and that would likely drag the United States into even deeper conflict. So I think, when I use the term abyss, I'm talking about just the utter annihilation of Gaza. I'm talking about the prospects of a region-wide war. And, if the United States is supposedly serious about, focusing on great power competition or, combating China or, focusing on pressing domestic issues here at home, none of that will be possible if the United States finds itself in another disastrous war in the region.
In that regard, since you mentioned American or U.S. interests a number of times, what do you see as U.S. interests being? Because I feel like there are certain people when I use the term, well, this U.S.-Israel special relationship is not in U.S. interests. They'll say, well, you're talking about American interests. Like I've had people say, oh, that sounds nationalistic to talk in terms of American interests, which I think is a really bizarre statement, but. So maybe you can explain to people that don't understand what we mean by American interests. You can explain that.
Sure. So by American interests, on a more broader level, I mean the safety and prosperity of the American people and upholding the values that we as a country claim to stand for. When it comes to the Middle East in particular, our interests are pretty limited, maintaining the free flow of oil, trying to prevent the Middle East from becoming, a hub for terrorism that could attack the United States or its partners abroad. And, overall, preventing the dominance of any one country in the Middle East, in other words, the emergence of a regional hegemon. These are our three core interests in the region, and all of them are pretty easy to obtain and are all actually, I would argue, undermined by our overly militarized approach to the region and by supporting our partners in the region who pursue policies that are detrimental to regional stability. This, fuels the grievances that lead to terrorism and armed resistance and things like that. This,
So it's leading
fuels.
right now to a lot of anger on the Arab street, as they call it,
No, exactly. So, this fuels anger. This fuels geopolitical competition between states that could, that could actually, lead to a disruption in oil supplies or something like that. So this really, and it also leads to a lot of U.S. policy failures that other countries like Russia and China can swoop in and just pick up very opportunistic gains. So, all of our interests in the region, I argue, are limited. They're easy to achieve, but an overly militarized approach on behalf of the United States undermines all of them.
Two more questions if you have the time. The first doesn't have to do with Israel, but rather Saudi Arabia. Something I often hear when talking about the Saudi-US relationship is, we can't we have our hands tied when it comes to Saudi Arabia because oil. How do you respond to people that say that? Because I get the impression you don't think we should have like a unidirectional relationship with the Saudis either.
Yeah, so when because I get this question all the time. So when I get this question, I always say, people that argue that typically don't understand how global oil markets work. The United States, yes, is reliant upon oil, but from Saudi Arabia, for example, we only get 7% of our oil. But again, oil is a global commodity, so it's impacted by global supply and demand. Saudi Arabia is incapable of weaponizing oil against the United States because that would undermine Saudi interests. We shouldn't pretend that oil producers don't have an incentive to produce. Mohammed bin Salman needs this money from oil, especially because Vision 2030 is going so poorly. He can play with the taps. He can try and do things like, cutting 1 million barrels a day, here and there as, gestures towards the United States. But he can't play with the taps too much because he's reliant upon this in his own authoritarian restructuring within Saudi Arabia. And the last point that I'll make on that issue is we also should recognize that, the United States gets 7% of its oil from Saudi Arabia. China gets over 50% of its oil from the Gulf. So if there is a disruption to the global oil trade, if they start playing with the tap, so on and so forth, that is going to hurt an oil importing China far more than it is the United States.
The last thing I wanted to ask you is how you became involved in, looking at the Middle East in relation to geopolitics, because I want you to talk about how you came to study that and how you came to your views on the region and U.S. foreign policy in the region, because I think some people are going to listen to this and say, oh, they're going to see that you're involved with Cato. And they're going to say, oh, that's the libertarian think tank. I don't agree with their politics. And I think if you explained how you came to your views on the Middle East beyond, any political considerations or beyond a political ideology, people would maybe understand where you're coming from more than just hearing, oh, you work for Cato. Do you get where I'm coming from when I ask you this? I hope.
No, absolutely. So, where I come from with studying this issue is purely from an academic background. I remember, so I'm 28, and, we grew up in the post 9/11 era. The Middle East was front and center on the news every single night. And I had extended family members that worked in the government, on Middle East issues, so on and so forth. And I started to see, they would often talk about the region, so on and so forth. And I would start to think in my head, like, that just doesn't sound right to me. And so, I got more interested into the topic. I went off to George Mason University for my undergrad and ended up staying for my master's and my PhD, and was really, brought up in an environment where I, challenged underlying assumptions regarding U.S. Middle East policy. And the more and more that I got involved in the policy space, all of this is stemming from my academic background and research, so on and so forth. So, I often like to say, I come from a small rural town. I have no vested interest in, what the United States does in the Middle East or not. This is just all, for me, driven by an academic project to further, American interests, to further, global peace, so on and so forth.
In that regard, do you think your article, I would say it transcends, being a left-right thing. I think people on the left or the right can look at this article and say, hey, maybe he has a point.
No, exactly. And that's what I hope, and that's what I hoped to get across with this article, was whether you are on the left, whether you are on the right, whether you are up or down, so on and so forth, just take a look at the piece, really, take a step back and say, what is the United States getting from this relationship? Is it advantageous for us? Is it advantageous for Israel? And, what would a more normal relationship and a more normalized foreign policy in the Middle East look like? And as we're heading towards, a very turbulent domestic and international, time, the Middle East, is kind of at the heart of it right now. And we need to fundamentally reassess what are we doing.
Well, hey, Joan Hoffman, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work, any social media that you have? And then is there anything, what would you want my listeners, if they got one thing out of this conversation, what's the one thing you really want them to take away from it?
Sure. So, in terms of keeping up with the work, you can follow me at Twitter, at Hoffman8John, JON. But in terms of, if there's one thing that I really would like listeners to take away, is, 8 decades of what I would argue are failed policies in the Middle East, are shared, the support for these policies are shared by the majorities on both sides of the political aisle. So this isn't a left-right issue. This is an issue of what is in the best interests of the United States, and is that being reflected in Washington? And I would say neither party is really reflecting these interests or pursuing a policy in the region that advanced the interests of the American people, but rather political elites, special interests, so on and so forth. And with this article, it focuses on Israel specifically, but I've focused on, the UAE and Saudi and Egypt, so many other countries, trying to bring this back to a point of what are we getting out of these engagements? And that's really, I think, the number one thing I would try to, get push people towards.
Thank you again, John Hoffman, for coming on Parallax Views.
Oh, thank you, JG.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with John Hoffman and that you'll consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. If you can donate anything, $1, $5, which is really good, or above, it could really be what keeps this show going. If you like the content I produce, your donation to the Patreon would be very much appreciated, as it is you, the listener, that makes this show possible. I only have one advertiser, the mighty Mike Swanson of Wall Street Window, but otherwise, this show is completely listener-funded. So, patreon.com/parallaxviews if you want to help out. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.